be time. It could be.
There could be time. Yes, if it didn't blow up immediately, and it chances of that happening were slim. Every time you hit an airplane with those heavy weapons, it didn't necessarily mean she was going to blow right up. You might do a lot of damage, and you might knock it down, but there'd still be somebody alive to take dumping action. So that was this is what was we were trying to convince the cabinet of and on this whole thing.
Well, now, did you have anything to do, or were you at all involved at the time when the first suggestion was made?
Not on nuclear weapons.
No, I'm talking about the Bullmark itself.
Oh, the Bullmark. I honestly can't remember. I don't think I did, because being in the program shop, that would have been more in the plans and in the policy shop, and there. Who would have, and with the operators who would initially have started the discussions going and getting that up the line. I would have been on the receiving end once I got into the act. Of course, once the thing started to roll and I knew it was in the program. Well, I had to get it in the program. Once the thing was sort of the way the system worked, was it anything could come up from any one of the various cells, whether it be on the technical side, the personnel side, on the operational side, or even the financial side of the house. It would go to the Air Council. And if it was approved at Air Council to go on, then that was my cue to pick it up. There was something now that had been accepted in principle by the Air Council and therefore was a part of our program, subject to further approval. But I had to start working it in because as far as we were concerned, the program was going to go. Therefore, all the implications of that program, I had to take into consideration in working out the total program for the Air Force. The manpower implications, the money implications, lead times, and then make sure that if it was new equipment, what about the accommodation for it? Were there construction implications? Once you start down that road, you're off into a million different angles. But it was my job to spark all those and make sure that the thing was going to come together at the end. It was all going to come together at the right moment, the right time. Now, so I did not get involved in the actual details of the Bullmark policy decisions initially, any more than I did on the nuclear ones.
Well, once you did get involved, what was your own reaction to it? I mean, here's sort of a pilotless airplane.
Oh, yes. No, I guess I'd better make it a personal one, because I can't say we. That might imply that the air staff felt the same way. But although I don't think I was, my thinking was very different from most of the pilots, it was a very limited weapon, limited in its capability. It was a point defense weapon. Point defense with a fair amount of range, but it was still a point defense weapon. And as with all point defense weapons, you can go around them. You can end run them and escape. Well, or you can beat them one way or another. You can beat them electronics. You can beat them with, in other words, electronic jamming or something like this. Or you can beat them by being down low. There are ways that you can get around those kind of weapons. And we felt that the man was still a pretty important person even in that fairly high state of technology. That it was when something went wrong that you needed your man to make a decision and say, well, what's the best thing to do now? And then go ahead and do it with some chance of success. So we argued that the Bullmark was a point defense system, and therefore we would rather have had airplanes. But again, we now go back to the Arrow. The program had all been gone down the drain. It was a question of finding something that was cheap and would provide some defense. And so Bullmark was accepted. I don't know who the prime mover behind Bullmark was. Whether it came from the minister or not, I really don't remember. But someone was a prime mover, and it became a part of our inventory. Fortunately, not to the total exclusion of the aircraft, because the 101 program came along and to replace the CF-100s. Yeah. But there's no mobility to a point defense system. Not of that ilk, there is. While it, as I say, it had a fairly good range, and you had to put, if you were going to have a good system, you'd have to put so damn many of them around that the cost would then start to go off the clock.
Yeah, but I don't think the idea ever was to for it to be anything but point defense in that particular area where we had the concentration of our major cities.
Well, perhaps, but it was you only had X number of weapons.
Yeah.
Once they were launched, again, that was it.
Yeah.
There were no replacements.
Yeah. But on the other hand, if you have an air force, you know, with a not an air force, but if you have an airfield with a couple of squadrons on it,
yes,
and that airfield is blam there, right, wide open to anything. I think, insofar as costs are concerned, that the Bomark certainly would equate with that.
Well, with the airplanes, of course, you had the business of recovery, and you could recover in all sorts of places and rearm and then go on and catch them on the way back if there was any chance of them getting back. In other words, the idea was to attrition.
Mm.
But it was an argument that the pros and cons really didn't amount to very much, because a decision was made to put Bomarks in, and that was it. And we had, what, two bases, I guess it was. Lamakhazi was one, and
yeah.
North Bay
yeah.
was the other, the
yeah.
two Bomark bases.
Yeah.
But that still didn't cover the run coming down the Atlantic seaboard.
No,
which, of course, was getting, and that's what I mean by an end run.
Yeah. But again, you know, I'm trying to think of the times. We just didn't have then, or indeed now, a sufficient number of squadrons, airfields, all the rest of it, to defend the whole country.
I see what you mean. Yes, I see what you mean. Yes, yes. In that respect, it's quite true. But remember that by this time we were in NORAD.
Yeah.
And the whole concept of NORAD was an advanced base concept where you'd bring forth you'd bring everything forward.
Yeah, bring the Americans up.
Bring the Americans up.
That's especially right. In the West, I guess.
That's right. Bring the Americans up, and then fall back, if it was necessary to fall back.
Yeah.
So that it wasn't just the Canadian squadrons; it was a question of the total resources of NORAD.
Yeah.
And the commander of NORAD could allocate his resources anywhere he wanted, as long as he had time to move them. That was his problem. His problem was to be able to make a decision and say move, knowing that his airplanes would be able to get on the ground, refuel, and be ready to operate in time to carry out an interception or to back up those which were already there, depending on how the bombers were coming in. And this is why so many NORAD exercises were held. This was one of the big things in a NORAD exercise. The first indication of enemy aircraft would appear in one area, and then there'd be start to be a flow of them. All right, is that going to be the one and only attack? Is this the main channel they're using, or are there going to be others? And so the commander had to sit back, but he was always fighting the clock. He reached the point where he had to make a decision. Now, which one was it going to be? And if he guessed right, fine. If he guessed wrong, then he was scrambling, trying to recall, and then the fun started.
Yeah.
You start to get on the wrong side of the power curve. So, I suppose in terms of total defense, of course, Canada could never defend itself.
Yeah, well, this is just, of course,
never,
always
never.
A problem.
And
well, how long would it take, shall we say, a squadron of American planes, to come from, well, let's say that for some reason or other they had to land in, shall we say, Edmonton or North Bay or what have you.
Yeah. They come.
How long would it take them to refuel?
Well, let's start with the warning. We would get our first warning through the dew line. Something was happening through the dew line. If it was an end run across the Pacific, we'd hope and pray that there might be something up from the Aleutians, or there's some ship or some kind of reporting that something was happening. But mainly the dew line, because range is a problem here. Now, as soon as we started to get constant reports from the dew line, you've got a long way to go from the dew line down to what was then the Mid-Canada line, and then down into the Pine Tree line, into the actual radars themselves. So there was ample time for the commander to sit back and look at the incoming raid and say, all right, it's all going to come down that one route, and for the sake of argument, it's going to come down the Mackenzie Valley and then down through Alberta. He would then have ample time to move up the squadrons from in Montana, and even south of Montana, to get them up into a position at in Edmonton, Coal Lake, places like that, so that they would be ready to intercept. And then they could fall back now and refuel and turn them around. Yeah. Well, ample time. Ample time. There would be no problem there at all. Because the crews would start. We must always assume there would be a period of some form of tension. Crews would probably be at less than an hour readiness, probably 15-minute readiness. And therefore, there would be no question of getting them launched from their base. They'd be already armed initially. They'd be armed, and they would fly armed.
Yeah.
One of the great things about the NORAD agreement was that it gives permission for NORAD, to Commander Chief NORAD, for aircraft to fly with nuclear weapons, which they're not allowed to do in peacetime, of course. Even though those would be American airplanes, not Canadian planes, because the Canadian planes would only be released really on the authority of the president, when it looked pretty grim.
Yeah.
But the Americans could carry them, although there'd be no authority to use them. There's a vast difference between carrying them and using them, the authority to fire. So, it worked, and it was a feasible plan, and it did work. Yes, it did work.
Yeah.
But the NORAD agreement, it had come into being, and of course, even with NORAD, there was a lot of time was spent answering questions from the politicians.
Yeah.
And they always, it seemed that every question started with why, and so therefore away you went. And one of the things about the plan shop, and I finally had to set up one man who did nothing but reply to what we called minquires. These were questions from Hansard on the floor of the House, or written questions to the minister, which could come from anywhere. They could come from a constituent or so forth. But a lot of those wound up in the plan shop, and we had to answer all those damn things for the minister, and that took a lot of time, just preparing answers or preparing a statement that he could make in the House. Giving him the facts. I don't mean that we actually wrote the statement, but because his staff would. But we would provide him with the information that he would need to on which to base the statement, the facts, so to speak. One of the other things that, during this time period, in talking of NORAD, was this business of the extension of the radar system across Canada from the initial program. And this, again, was when George Birks was... the minister, when the chiefs of staff had approved the plan, I forget the sums that were involved, but it was a multi-million-dollar program, and there were several hundreds of troops involved too in the program. But the chiefs, I had briefed the chiefs of staff on this, and they had approved it to be presented to the minister. So it was arranged that. The minister would be briefed one morning, and I would do the briefing. So I arrived down at his office, and I had all the charts, the maps, the details, the costing of the program, and the spread of the cost in terms of fiscal years and how the money would be spent in future years and so forth. And he came in, and he said, "Good morning, Lane." I said, "Good morning, sir." And he said, "Are you doing the briefing?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "I want a very informal briefing. I don't want any charts, nothing like that. I just want a very informal briefing." Well, I sort of just shrugged, because here we were talking about radar coverage, and I have no idea how you would explain radar coverage to someone without a map with a circle on it, and particularly when you get down to overlapping radar coverage and the need for the overlap and the countermeasures that are involved. So I went in, and I told the chief as he came in, I said, "The minister has asked for a very informal briefing, and he doesn't want any charts." But I said, "There's no way I can do this briefing without charts, so I intend just to go ahead." And he said, "Yes." He said, "I don't see how you can do it otherwise." Well, we went in, and I gave the briefing, which was a fairly comprehensive one. It must have gone on for, a good 30, 35 minutes, because there was a lot involved, a lot of implications vis-a-vis the Americans. All sorts of things, as well as the funding and the manpower and how we were going to get the manpower or how much more we would need, the impact on the budget of another big major program. Well, it was a very complex briefing. And when I finished, the chiefs and the chairman, all there sitting, and they waited for the minister to speak, because I have said I'm finished and I'm trying to answer any questions. And it was then he said, "How do you expect me to explain this to the Prime Minister when he hasn't spoken to me in 3 or 4 months, whichever it was?" And my God, you could have heard a pin drop in that room for I don't know how long. And the minister didn't smile when he said it either. And we knew that he was having a difficult time with the Prime Minister at that particular time, but we didn't know how bad until he made that comment. So I can only assume that it was as near as a damn it a truthful statement. Well, everyone's face dropped, because of course the minister, it was only through the minister that we were going to get this program up to the PM, and then after he had given at least its verbal blessing, get it to cabinet. Or to the Cabinet Defense Committee. However, I give Perks full marks, because I don't know what happened, but a little later he called the chief and he said, "I've managed to talk to the Prime Minister and that can go to cabinet." And so we wrapped the whole thing up and it went to cabinet and it was approved by cabinet. And then, of course, we launched off on the construction of the extension of what was the original Pine Tree Line, and we put all the stations in at Beausejour and across the prairies and then up into where they joined up with BC. Yeah. So there were a number of stations. And those ones ultimately were manned. I remember part of this problem of manning was American manning too.
Yeah. Now,
this had to all be explained. And there was, again, all the trials and tribulations of that.
Well, I think, Reg, as I remember it, one of the big difficulties, if you want to call it such, was trying to explain in the House of Commons the business of NORAD command and control.
Yes.
In other words, who did what to whom before something actually happened.
Yeah.
Now, I remember, for example, Perks talking to me about it, and the idea was, of course, that the chiefs of staff or the chairman of the chiefs of staff or what have you, both sides agree that the Russians are up to something nasty. There's 1,000 Russian aircraft coming over to us. They would report it to their respective premier or prime minister and president. These two would contact each other and mutually agree that this had to be done, and then the word would go to NORAD. Now, I remember speaking on one occasion to Perks and thinking in terms of how the hell you're going to carry out this sort of communication. And I said, "Well, sir, did you have a radio receiver set, sending set in your car?" "No, he didn't, as I remember. But he said I always let my secretary or what have you know where I was going, so that when he went to a show or to a party, they could reach him." And he also mentioned to me, I'd have to check my notes on this, that sometimes when Mr. Diefenbaker went to bed, that he would order his switchboard operator at the Prime Minister's house to pull all the wires out. He didn't want to be disturbed. And when he mentioned this, I said, "Well, now, you know, if something happened in a hurry, they couldn't get hold of you, they couldn't get hold of the Premier, what the hell is going to happen at NORAD?" And he said, I imagine the commander of NORAD would do his thing, do his duty." Which I can only imagine.
Yeah.
You would have done.
Well, the question of time was not so very important in the early days when the manned bomber was the only threat. But as soon as they started to develop missiles, then of course the whole picture changed. But what you were describing and what he was describing is in the agreement under the heading consultation.
Yeah.
And there will be consultation. And between the government and between the Prime Minister and the President and all this sort of nonsense. Well, you're quite right. This implies an adequate communication system. Well, the Americans have got that adequate communication system, but I'm afraid that we never really did develop it, and even to this day, I don't think that we have adequate communication so that Canada, the Canadian government, can play its part properly in the event of an attack. And what he says is quite right, that St. NORAD and the President would make decisions, and we would be agreeing after the fact.
Yeah.
And this has happened on exercises. Well, I'm kind of jumping ahead here a wee bit, but during exercises down at NORAD, I found this.
Yeah.
I would be talking, in an exercise, I would be talking to the airborne command post somewhere over the eastern United States flying around.
Yeah.
And the man who was in the airplane acting as the president. Now, I had no idea who the hell I was talking to, but probably one of the president's staff was on board that airplane.
Yeah.
And then I would phone Ottawa to try and get a tie-in for a joint decision. And I would get a colonel who was acting prime minister, and he would be no idea what the hell was going on to begin with, and it was pretty desperate. So I would then say, all right, I will make the Canadian decision as the senior Canadian at NORAD. And then I would make the decision. And then I would tell the staff at NDHQ to advise the minister and the chief what the hell was happening, what the decision was, and do it right now. Get on the bloody horn.
Yeah.
Well, there isn't time.
Would they be able to get back to you in time?
No way. No, because we're now talking in terms of, now, mind you, as I say, we're jumping ahead, we're now talking missile attack.
Yeah.
So we're talking in terms of just a few minutes.
Yeah.
And there isn't time to... we'd explain it to them, and I would, quite often, I would hold on right to the last minute, and I used to take great pleasure in saying, I have just run out of time. This is my decision. You inform them, and that's it. And then I would turn, and then on the NORAD command council, at the command post, and then the orders would go up, whatever they might be.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's jumping ahead. But what you just found about was consultation, which... The original NORAD agreement tried to bring all this together in the original NORAD agreement. And curious enough, the original NORAD agreement it hasn't changed that much. It's been rewritten a couple of times, but an awful lot of it is still the original wording, the original agreement.
Yeah.
And there are certain things in that agreement, which I'll come to later, which still are inhibiting between Canada and the United States.
Yeah.
And for no good purpose, none whatsoever, and yet for some stupid reason, we insist on adhering to certain wording in the existing NORAD agreement. So there's always been, I think the Americans have always wondered how good an ally we are when we would sign all these things and agree to fight a war, but then would not take the relatively simple steps required to ensure that the decision-making apparatus would work.
A war if necessary, but not necessarily a war. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Well, where were you again? I suppose you'd be in finance and intelligence at the time. Another great kerfuffle came up with respect to NORAD, and that, of course, was the problem of atomic weapons.
I thought you were going to refer to the other, what was equally as contentious an issue, which were the rules of engagement. When a pilot gets airborne, what does he do? Because there was great concern about shooting down bombers over Canadian territory when they could go on and get shot down over the United States, and this sort of thing. And if I remember, it was Tommy Douglas who made a big issue of this, the NDPs, about shooting down bombers over our territory. What a disaster this was going to be, and what were the rules of engagement.
There was an
enormous kerfuffle. I didn't get too deeply involved in that, because the rules of engagement were the operational side of the house. It was their responsibility to answer all those. But I can recall I was on the edges of it, and oh dear, there were hours and hours and hours written, at least spent, writing up replies to the rules of engagement, which were agreed to between Canada and the United States. There's a signed document on the rules of engagement of what you have to do when you intercept, and how you go about it, and before you start shooting.
Surely to God, you blast them out of the sky.
Well, no, you don't, because then that's the whole point. you don't, because if
you get them a written permission.
That's right, because the politicians are frightened that you might make a mistake and shoot down a friendly airplane or a friendly passenger airplane or something like that. So it gets to be very tricky. Rules of engagement are damn tough. They make it very difficult for someone to fight a war. Unless there is a great big bomber stream and masses of them coming over, and there's no question about who the hell they are. Or when war has been declared. I mean, there's a vast difference between before war has been declared by the government,
yeah,
and after war has been declared. Because before war has been declared, you're not at war, and therefore you don't go around shooting people down.
It's very political. Yeah, in other words, you could have a dozen, Russian bombers over our territory without a war being declared.
And the rules, the primary aspect of the rules of engagement is that you are not allowed to shoot it down unless it has taken an act of provocation, which was not defined. And of course, we always read that as that it's dropped a bloody bomb.
Yeah.
See, and then you can shoot it down. So, and that is where consultation would come in. There would have to be consultation before the event of war being declared. What do we do? Do we shoot these things down? Because if we do, what are the implications of shooting it down? The rules of engagement are very tedious, and every pilot had to know the rules of engagement bass-ackwards because of the political overtones of it. And it was an absolute bind. Because you're quite right. If you have a bomber coming in and you identify it, obviously it shouldn't be there, the natural reaction is to shoot the bloody thing down before it does any damage.
Right.
But rules of engagement, they don't read that way. It's not that simple.
Well, all right.
Once the war is declared,
yeah,
then there has been some act somewhere that has brought on a declaration of war. And once you get to a declaration of war, then you're all right. Another aspect of before war being declared, too, was the release of nuclear weapons. Who was going to authorize a Canadian in an airplane to release a nuclear weapon to shoot down a bomber before there has been war declared? This is the sort of thing that you get into. Aside from the possibility of a mistake or anything like that, it gets very, very complex. And the opposition, of course, were trying their damnedest to make it even more difficult because the NDP didn't want any part of the defense budget. They didn't want NORAD. They didn't want NATO initially. They just didn't want
anything. They were very divided. They were very...
They were. But Tommy Douglas, who was very... vocal on this, would never miss an opportunity to try to embarrass the government and voice his opinion, which was Canada should not be spending a cent on defense, it should be spending it all on social programs.
That's right.
So it was always, and yet the damn questions and the positions always had to be answered. And it was just like a barrage of lawyers lined up trying to find the flaw, a legal flaw, in a statement. So they could protract the discussion and again with the aim of embarrassing the government or proving a point.
Yeah.
And it became very tedious. I can remember that one went on and on and on. And I can remember one time the chief throwing his hands up in the air and said, "How in Christ do we teach these bastards?" And literally, he just about reached the end of his tether in trying to find the words to explain the situation that would prevail. Because as I say, it was almost as if a barrage of lawyers were on the other side. Yeah. Asking the questions, all right, if you do that, what about so-and-so? And it would go on and on and on and on and on.
In a case like that, cannot the minister bring in his chief opponents and give them a restricted or private
No,
briefing?
That was never done, and it never has been done. I've suggested that two or three times, but it was never done. I don't know why. It's certainly foreign to Canadian politics, although I understand they do it in the UK. Certainly in the States they bring in the leaders in the Senate and brief them on a need-to-know basis or on a secure basis. But we never have, and I don't know why we don't do it. I, as I say, advocated a few times because I felt that the only way to keep them... Sometimes the politicians in the House would make completely irresponsible statements. They were not made deliberately. They were made from ignorance.
Yeah.
And the only way to stop them from making those kind of statements was to bring them into the picture and brief them.
Yeah.
So that if they did make it in the future, they would know it. They would do it knowingly and know it as, or that it could be interpreted as an irresponsible statement.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it was never done that way.
So it and the other time, of course, they had the opportunities to have a crackdown. Remember, there wasn't even in those days we didn't even have a committee on defense as we now have.
Well, you're just getting into it, I think.
Well, getting close to it, but certainly yeah. I can't remember anyone. I can't remember the chief appearing before it, and certainly I never did. Or the vice chief at that time, although later, of course, I did appear before the committee. But the other time when they had an opportunity to ask all kinds of questions, of course, was when the estimates were before the House, when the House was in a committee of a whole and handling estimates. And the number of times I have sat in the balcony in the House during estimates, particularly during the sort of the vote one, which was the general, the minister's own salary and all that sort of thing, when they could really get at anything, mm-hmm. policy particularly. And I sat up there and had to scribble answers, or when the minister would start to speak, you'd look up as much as say, am I saying the right thing? And you'd nod and say, that's right, sort of encourage him.
Yeah.
Or shake your head and start to write quickly, and it would be run down to him with the goddamn answer, and the deputy minister would be there as well, of course. And those were, again, long, tedious hours, sitting there waiting to and having to answer off the top of your head some of the stuff that would come up.
Yeah.
But that all went with the job. That term as Chief of Plans and Intelligence was a very, very difficult time. There were good moments, such as that one on the 101 swap deal. Another one, all of a sudden, the Yukon transport was coming into service, and we had not done any real thinking about a transport policy for the armed forces. We'd had North Stars and we'd used them as we saw fit, but we'd never had anything with the 130s and the Yukons. We now had a good carrying capacity, and for the first time we were in a position where we could lift some of the army, whereas before we couldn't. You know, we'd throw 50 people in the back of a North Star and they'd all be deaf by the time they got to wherever they were going.
You know, dreadful.
Dreadful. So we needed a whole new approach to transport. And really what we needed was a transport system. But we'd never done any thinking about what that system should be, what it would look like.
Yeah.
Even down to some pretty basic fundamental thinking. So I headed up a group, and we were given 6 weeks to put together the whole thing for a transport system. Right down to establishments. Well, that was a very, very big order, because it took us, we worked 7 days a week for 6 weeks, and we were working till 10, 11 o'clock every night. And when we finished, we were all pretty well washed out, but we had what we had set out to do, which was a full system. And we started with a policy. We've got transport. How do we use them? How many hours should they fly? What should we do? And it took us quite some time before we evolved the principle that a transport force is something that will be called on to operate very quickly and suddenly, both in peacetime and wartime, and therefore it must have the capacity under those